And good afternoon. It is one bell of the afternoon watch, and this is your Captain Joe up in the captain's chair in the Gene Bosch Memorial Studio on the magical isle of Vashon for our weekly muster. And this week is a special week for me personally and professionally because my friend and colleague, Captain and Doctor and Professor Lawson Brigham will be with us in just a few minutes. And we're going to talk about the Arctic, and we're going to talk about, in particular, the Russian activities in the Arctic, and a couple of other things as well, because we have been friends and colleagues for many, many years. He is also a classmate of mine at the University of Cambridge, and so we always have a great deal about which to talk, and so we are going to get right into it. But first of all, my greetings today go all to Captain Joe's people all over the world, and in particular those who are deployed about their father's business. I did a little bit of introspection and a little bit of introspective work in this last week because last week I broadcast from the departure ceremonies for Polar Sea. And then a friend sent me a photograph of Polar Sea as she was being pulled out of the Coast Guard base and at the end of a towing hawser being towed by a civilian tug, a humiliation that is hard for me to endure and even harder for those who commanded or sailed in Polar Sea. And Captain Brigham is one of those who commanded her, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. But my greetings today go out to all of those people in all of our military who are deployed on their father's business all over the world. My second greetings, of course, always go out to the binnacle list. The binnacle list today is not has expanded a little bit because signals have been coming into me from all over the world, and in particular in Stockholm. And a person who does not know that she is one of Captain Joe's people does not know what the binnacle list is, but I have put her on it because she is undergoing some very serious testing and some very serious treatment, and it is for that terrible nemesis that I'd have to talk about so frequently on the binnacle list, a cancer. And so to all of Captain Joe's people who are on the binnacle list, my greetings, all of you remain as always in the palm of my hand, and that if you follow the instructions of your medical practitioner, it is my hope, my wish, and my command that you will leave the binnacle list in the approved fashion and not in the way that we always do not want to have happen. Now, Captain Brigham, how about coming on the board with me?
Good afternoon, Captain Joe. It's always my pleasure to be on your show.
So, Lawson, you and I have been together for in many different ways and in many different circumstances. And most recently, we honored the memory of your uncle and my friend, Captain Ray Copen. And I'd like you to do two things right now to begin the program. And the first one is a short but pithy characterization of your relationship to Captain Copen, who was a brown shoe, not a black shoe like you and I are. That's the first thing. And then I'd like you to talk a little bit about your captaincy in Polar Sea, and in particular, the voyage that you took her to the North Pole. So let's start with Captain Copen and then seg from that into a short but pithy talk about Polar Sea and your relationship with her.
Thank you, Captain Joe. Yeah, my uncle, Ray Copen, Captain, U.S. Coast Guard, retired, graduated from the Coast Guard Academy in 1954. And remarkably, I went to his graduation when I was 6 years old and caught the bug, so to speak, and went to the Academy as a cadet, about 12 years later, in 1966. Ray Copen was Distinguished Coast Guard Aviator, flew almost all the planes and helicopters we had in the service from the 1950s all the way into the 1980s. He was my mother's brother, and so it was my good fortune to know him as an uncle, maybe as an older brother, and as a distinguished officer. So we communicated a lot over the years. I miss him now, but he had a good life. He was an honorable, great person, and it was my great fortune to have him as my my relative. Yeah, I had the good fortune of being the commanding officer of Polar Sea, one of America's few icebreakers then and now. And we, on one of the voyages, crossed the Arctic Ocean in 1994, actually 30 years almost to the day that we, meaning the Coast Guard cutter Polar Sea and the Canadian Coast Guard ship Louis S. St. Laurent, combined on a scientific expedition from Bering Strait to the North Pole and then out into the Atlantic through Fram Strait. So it was, in fact, the first surface ship crossing of the Arctic Ocean, and it was ice-covered. If we went today, it would be partially ice-covered, but we found ice from just north of Bering Strait all the way to the North Pole and then out off Greenland and the strait between Greenland and Svalbard. Completely about 2,200 miles across the top of the world, all kinds of different types of ice, all for conducting science. We did arrive at the North Pole, and a day later, the Russian icebreaker, the Yamal, also arrived there, too, with a group of children aboard. So the three ships, roughly 400 people, 450 people, had a barbecue on the ice at the top of the world, which was quite extraordinary and unusual. And then just later in my tour, I took the ship down to Antarctica, and we also reached the southernmost point in the world where a ship can go in the deep in the Ross Sea, still about 660 miles to South Pole. But nonetheless, we nudged the ship up to the ice edge, left a little bit of red paint to say we were there. And so in the four voyages we took, two of the voyages, the ship went essentially to the extreme ends of the global ocean. Quite remarkable set of voyages. And I was lucky during my tenure to be aboard as a commanding officer and to go to both ends of the world and conduct science and break into McMurdo and take scientists and State Department people around both ends of the planet. All in 1994, 30 years ago.
Do you, Captain, do you remember who was the captain in Louis at the time? Was that...
Captain Bill Grandy is his name.
Uh-huh.
Bill Grandy had spent at least 30 years as a sailor in the Canadian Coast Guard. And I knew him, which was very useful and helpful as we started this voyage. We weren't quite convinced that we would reach the North Pole. The ice was quite difficult. But having the two ships and be able to transfer fuel from Polar Sea to Louis Saint Laurent and vice versa if we had to, we were able to accomplish what many thought was not possible. So, working with Captain Grandy and his crew, we worked seamlessly together on this joint venture.
So you bring up a point that is something, as you well know, is close to my heart, and that is our relationship with the Canadian Coast Guard. And you and I both have been, I am, of course, by marriage related to half of Canada, but also you and I together have worked with the Canadian Coast Guard in several different relationships. Mine, of course, was when I was the group commander up in Sault Ste. Marie, And there was essentially no border between the two countries, between the American Sioux and the Canadian Sioux. And I had a wonderful, very open working relationship with my Canadian Coast Guard colleagues there, which was extended then when you and I worked together when I was the ICE boss for Jim Gracie, one of the great gentlemen of our service. And so your experience with Polar Sea is remarkable in that you did indeed visit as close as you could get to the South Pole. Was that in the Bay of Whales or close to the somewhere in the...
Close to it, yeah, along the Rice Ice Shelf. And,
yeah.
It was very close. I mean, it's hard to be exact because, of course, fascinating is that the southernmost location on the planet where a ship can go is dynamic. In other words, moving.
Yes.
With the ice shelf. So in the time of Roland Amundsen, back when he went to the South Pole, early 20th century, he was closer to the pole. So the Fram was alongside the ice edge near Roosevelt Island and closer to the pole by a few miles. And so very interesting that the ice has advanced.
Yes.
Under climate change. So anyway, it's a complicated claim of what ship is. But Polar Sea is certainly among the most famous of Coast Guard cutters. Not the most famous, but among them. Along with many of the great ships of the Coast Guard's history,
Myo Ningham.
Yeah. All of the many of the cutters that have gone around the world and been in conflict, and of course around Alaska for sure, in the early days of the United States looking after its new territory, Alaska.
So let us take ourselves to the present and even cast ourselves with lookouts as far forward in the eyes of the ship as is practicable and over the horizon into the Arctic. And I'm going to set the stage just a little bit by pointing out that you, my dear friend, Captain, Professor, Doctor, have been declared a hero of the Arctic. And I know that you are reluctant to discuss that, but that is, so far as your captain is concerned, Tango Sierra. And so you're going to talk a little bit about that, because that is going to set the stage for the time that we have remaining in our discussion of what's going on in the Arctic right now. So tell us about being a hero of the Arctic.
Sure, Captain Joe. I'm a little reluctant because the unusual title of this award includes hero. It's a High North Hero Award, and it's given by Norwegian University, Nord University, where they have a High North Center. Of course, the Norwegians, at least maybe 20 years ago, declared that their northern territory in Norway proper was High North, because it's hardly Arctic. There's not much permafrost, and it's ice-free. And so they called it politically, internally, High North. So this university has given out this award for the past 10 years to some politicians, to some ship owners, to university people, and investors. And so lo and behold, in May, I received an email from the director of the High North Center that I was the honoree this year. And he asked, interestingly enough, whether I would accept the award and come to Bodø, Norway. And so I did. The award is really for, I think, in my case, contributions to marine safety and environmental protection in the Arctic, to bringing some clarity to how to define the Arctic and other Arctic issues. So I was honored to accept it. I did, in my acceptance speech, say that pretty hard to call myself a hero when I, in one organization where there are great number of heroes that jump out of airplanes, that save vessels in rough water at sea, that fly around the world and rescue people, et cetera, and our Coast Guard personnel. But But maybe I said in reconciling this award that maybe I was a hero in quotes, only in the sense of challenging and working through the bureaucracies of the International Maritime Organization in London and the diplomats and the bureaucracy of the Arctic Council of the Arctic States. So in any event, I accepted the award and had to give a dinner speech and use some anecdotes from my Coast Guard career and working with the IMO and the Arctic Council that seemed to resonate with the folks. So I was honored to receive this award after decades of contribution after my Coast Guard career. I must say that there was no chance that I'd ever get this award if I had not gone to the Coast Guard Academy and of course, served at sea and six different cutters and commanding the Polar Sea, because that all of those experiences, unusual and unique as they are, provided the background to contribute to the world on this very narrow field of how to protect the Arctic Ocean and the people that live there. So anyway, I'm honored to have accepted this award.
So you mentioned in your modest description of this award the Arctic Council, and the term Arctic Council is well known to me, but is probably not to many of Captain Joe's people who listen. So please describe briefly and pithily the Arctic Council, what it does, and what our part in it is. And then I'd like you to make a commentary about the indigenous peoples and the organization that represents them, and see if you can make a connection there. Because we've not talked about the Sami and the other different names that they go by in the circumpolar world.
Yeah, sure. The Arctic Council is what's called in diplomatic terms an intergovernmental forum. In other words, it's not a treaty-bound, there isn't a treaty behind it. It was an agreement signed in 1996 in Canada. It's called Ottawa Agreement, I think. And anyway, it's this forum where the Arctic states, eight of them, of course, the United States and Russia and Denmark and Norway, Finland, Sweden, and Iceland. I don't think I've left anyone out. I hope I got them all. Canada, of course.
Canada,
eight,
yes.
Eight Arctic countries that actually own the place, right? That we have sovereign rights over almost all of the Arctic except the Central Arctic Ocean, which is a kind of a donut hole in the center. As you push your EEZ out 200 miles, and then there's a global commons at the top. But from 1996 until the days that the Russians invaded Ukraine, there's great cooperation among the eight states. In fact, I chaired a major study called the Arctic Marine Shipping Assessment from 2004 to 2009, and we had great cooperation among all the eight states to shape a framework to protect the environment and develop marine safety, have a SAR agreement, et cetera, et cetera. The Arctic Council, in many respects, has fallen on hard times now because of the invasion of Russia, being the largest Arctic state. But the invasion, of course, one of the fallouts of this invasion was that NATO now, Finland and Sweden, after more than a century of neutrality, have joined NATO. So the Arctic table, so to speak, when the eight Arctic states are sitting there, seven of the eight Arctic states today are looking down at the table, so to speak, at the Russian Federation. So that's a new dynamic which has really caused great challenges among the seven NATO members and how they relate to Russia. I'll put it that way, I guess. So the Arctic Council is still functioning, but not at the diplomatic level, although there's some talk to bring the eight diplomats together, Arctic ministers of the eight Arctic states, and we in the U.S. have a minister, so to speak, senior State Department person. So the working groups of the Arctic Council are operating with some Russian participation only virtually now. The indigenous people, the uniqueness of this Arctic-Ottawa Charter, an agreement back in 1986, was to bring the indigenous people of the Arctic to the table as individual groupings, like the Inuit, and you mentioned the Salmi, the Aleuts are members, the Athabascans, and of course the Russian indigenous people as well, all in one collective called RIPON, the Russian Arctic Indigenous People of the North, I think is how it's said. So the indigenous people have had not a vote, but moral persuasion, I would say, and great influence on the direction of the studies and the work done in the Arctic Council. It's been one of the most positive aspects of this Arctic Council. I think I'll leave it at that. It's a bit sad to see the somewhat collapse of Arctic cooperation, but in the face of the aggressive invasion of Ukraine, I think it was a foregone conclusion that it would be very difficult to cooperate at the top of the world like we have in the last couple decades.
So do you think that we take the example of the Antarctic Treaty, and under the Antarctic Treaty, the cooperation among all of the signatories to the treaty is as complete as just about any both diplomatic and operational relationship that anybody could imagine. And as you indicated, the Arctic Council is not, and in fact, the Arctic itself is not governed by any overriding treaty like the Antarctic is. And so, based on your both considerable experience and your considerable work that you've done with the Arctic Council, what is your feeling as to how we might move forward in areas like search and rescue and mineral control of mineral extraction, things like that? Because it seems to me that the United States in particular is poorly equipped and unready, certainly not semper paratus, to deal with the next time that the bear puts out the claws.
Yeah, it's a tough question, except that there will never be an Arctic treaty like Antarctica. It's just not possible because of the sovereign state.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah, I understand
that. That's not, as you know, and Russian Federation would be the first to not agree to any kind of agreement. But you know, the Arctic Council, I didn't mention, focused on environmental protection and sustainable issues. Did not touch at all fisheries, whaling, and the seals that's under the IWC, the International Whaling Commission, and had no play in military security issues. So it was, and it continues to be, a very narrow but important part of the Arctic and cooperation, which is not happening right at the moment. I the future of the top of the world is complex and hugely uncertain. The only certainty in the place is that anthropogenic climate change is moving along. The place is getting warmer and warmer. It's less and less glacial ice. Still plenty of ice, for sure, but there's diminishing glacial ice and diminishing sea ice. The diminishing sea ice, of course, gives potential longer seasons as navigation, but the place is still ice-covered for 8-9 months out of the year, mid-century and beyond, so it's not like it's a new lake for the entire year. But cooperation is going to be very difficult, although I would note, though, today, and hopefully in the future here, the Arctic remains the most peaceful place on Earth, along with, of course, Antarctica. So the two poles are pretty peaceful. No one in their right mind wants any friction at the top of the world, particularly the Russians, who want to move cargo, move natural resources to global markets. So Mr. Putin and his team, the last thing they want, even though they're building up their coastal defenses and capability to something we've not seen in the past, clearly he does not want friction or even potential for conflict. Could be accidents, could be, you know, a major spill or something on the northern sea route that exercising the search and rescue agreement, the treaty, and also the treaty on oil spill preparedness and response remains to be seen how we can build up infrastructure under those treaties so they can be, could be, collaborative response to maritime, either spill or downed aircraft or sinking ship or whatever. So, you know, the Arctic is one of the places on the Earth, but I wouldn't say that it's one of the hot spots, so to speak. Just read the news every day. You can see hot spots around the world from Gaza, Ukraine, South China Sea, Taiwan. Long list of places that the United States and the world are dealing with. And so our capability, it depends upon what you think. I mean, how you describe, one describes capability. We certainly have extraordinary air power at the top of the world. We have maybe an adequate nuclear submarine force, but we, as you and I know very well, and many folks on the line have a meager icebreaker capability right now. The question is where and when, how much capability. We'll never have nor need the kind of capability our Russian friends have, because we don't have the kind of operation in the north that they seem to require for moving stuff out of the Arctic. But I'll leave it at that.
So you've not used the word China yet, and China is making a great incursion, and we only have 2 minutes left, so I'm going to take those 2 minutes to ask you to characterize your thoughts about China, and in particular, China taking ice-strengthened ships with ice class, not icebreakers, but ice class, going across the Northeast Passage under escort of nuclear-powered Russian icebreakers, because I know that there's been at least one convoy like that just in the last year.
Yeah, I mean, expression of how that transport system, and there are a lot of folks like Mr. Putin and the President of China who believe you can have an international waterway. Most of the people that I deal with in Maersk and many of the other companies, including Chinese companies, know that it's really a seasonal operation, and the real focus of the Northern Sea Route and marine transport there is on what we call destinational traffic, either tour ships, but principally tankers, LNG carriers, bulk carriers, moving stuff, moving natural resources out of the Russian Arctic to global markets. And so the Russians are using a convoy system to do that, to extend the navigation season, when many of the modern commercial ships are icebreakers in their own right. At least the LNG carriers built in South Korea using Finnish technology are really, truly icebreakers in their own right. The use of the Northern Sea Route and Northeast Passage by the Chinese, there's a lot of hype and misinformation about it, but nonetheless, China is interested whether these are shorter distances, as proclaimed by the media. I mean, I take issue with the way that it's characterized, because it may be shorter distances for a couple months out of the year, if that. But certainly when you apply an ice cover, which the place is ice covered, and you're doing 5-7 knots or something through the ice, obviously, the speeds being much slower make the distances actually longer than the global free water route. So there's a lot of mischaracterization and misinterpretation of what's happening. Nonetheless, the Arctic Ocean is being used more, and that's the reason for a lot of work. One other quick thing is clearly the way to handle Arctic issues is in international organizations today. And at the IMO, they are dealing with Arctic issues, emissions, global emissions from ships, emissions being greenhouse gases, carbon-based. And so many of these issues apply to the Arctic as well. The International Hydrographic Commission is dealing with charts. The Russians are members of that group. The World Meteorological Organization as well are dealing with climate change issues and data and information, particularly in the Arctic as well. So really there are organizations dealing with international, dealing with the Arctic and change. The United States is, of course, a proactive member of all of these.
So, Lawson, I'll have you on again soon. We are, as always, far too quickly at the end of our time together. This is your Captain Joe. As always, I'm on station and watching properly. We never say goodbye. We say until we meet again. And Lawson, Captain Brigham, you and I will meet again very soon, very shortly. All of you are in the palm of my hand. Take care of each other. Watch their six. And we'll meet here again next week.
Thank you, Captain.